to kick this thing off. Can I kick it off? One, two, three, boom.
Alright, here we go again, everybody. What's going on? It's Mr. Lutz, and we're back at it with another episode of World History Class with Mr. Lutz. Today's focus is going to be on the rise and the spread of Islam. New unit, new episode, let's begin. All right, so making our way into those key concept connections that you have grown to know and love so much. Since it's a new unit, I just think it's probably always a good idea to give you the long-winded overview of each key concept. And then as we get into successive episodes, I'll just hint at them with a lot fewer words to get to the point. So we'll start with the one that I think gets the most attention in Chapter 6, and that is Key Concept 3.1. Although Afro-Eurasia and the Americas remained separate from one another, this era witnessed a deepening and widening of networks of human interaction within and across regions. The results were unprecedented concentrations of wealth and the intensification of cross-cultural exchanges. Innovations in transportation, state policies, and mercantile practices contributed to the expansion and development of commercial networks, which in turn served as conduits for cultural, technological, and biological diffusion within and between various societies. Pastoral or nomadic groups played a key role in creating and sustaining these networks. Expanding networks fostered greater interregional exchanges while at the same time sustaining regional diversity. Islam, a new monotheistic religion, spread quickly through practices of trade, warfare, and the diffusion that was characteristic of this period. So to sum up 3.1, increased exchanges, basically. A key concept 3.2 says, state formation in this era demonstrated a remarkable continuity, innovation, and diversity in various regions. In Afro-Eurasia, some states attempted, with differing degrees of success, to preserve or revive imperial structures, while smaller, less centralized states continued to develop. The expansion of Islam introduced a new concept, the caliphate, to Afro-Eurasian statecraft. Pastoral peoples in Eurasia built powerful and distinctive empires that integrated people and institutions from both the pastoral and agrarian worlds. In the Americas, powerful states developed in both Mesoamerica and the Andean region. So 3.2, to sum up very quickly, focusing on state formation, so that's the P in our spice themes, just talking about some continuity, some things that remain the same, some new ideas, some new innovations, and diversity depending on region. Finally, key concept 3.3 says changes in trade networks resulted from stimulated increasing productive capacity with important implications for social and gender structures and environmental processes. Productivity rose in both agriculture and industry. Rising productivity supported population growth and urbanization, but also strained environmental resources and at times caused dramatic demographic swings. Shift in production and the increased volume of trade also stimulated new labor practices, including adaptation of existing patterns of free and coerced labor. Social and gender structures evolved in response to these changes. So that one's just talking about trade and the economy, which has impact on, like it says, social and gender structures, on the environment, on labor practices, kind of just basically increased economic productivity and the trickle-down effects that come from that. So once again, Chapter 6 is really focusing, I think, primarily on 3.1. So what I'm going to try to do is just kind of walk you through that chapter, give you a little bit of a narrative here, and explain how this chapter connects to your key concepts. All right, so beginning on page 126, going a little bit into page 127, what you'll see there, we'll call it the introduction when these pages appear this way. I don't want to say much about it. I think it kind of speaks for itself. What it does speak about, though, is kind of the context for 3.1, that is key concept 3.1 and key concept 3.2, helps you kind of understand some of the background shaping those developments and understanding some of these major patterns that come in out of period 3. But then we're going to get into the desert and the town part. And this gets a little bit more specific here. So this is trying to help you to understand what's the Arab world like prior to and even during the early life of Muhammad. And there's some key things here that I want to kind of go over with you. First of all, the fact that you have just such a vast desert on the Arabian Peninsula and the surrounding area leads to the development of these people who we call the Bedouin. And the Bedouin are going to be nomadic groups who typically organize themselves by either smaller family groups or even clan networks. And why they choose to organize themselves this way is because it's so essential to rely on these kinship groups for survival in such an environment that generates extremely fierce competition over these resources. And what this constant sense of competition is going to do is it's going to create instability and weakness among the people of Arabia. There really isn't going to be much to unite them beyond that immediate clan network. Why the Arabian world kind of matters at this point, what its role is in larger world history, is that it's going to help connect the Mediterranean world with the peoples of South and East Asia, and the closest empires that the people of the Arab world are going to have interactions with are going to be, at that time, the Persian Empire is going to be the Sasanian Empire, and then what we've called in prior episodes the Eastern Roman Empire, or more specifically, not more specifically, but more as we'll call them, the Byzantine Empire. What's happening with those two empires at this time is their imperial stability is really beginning to crumble a lot, and it leads to more trade that starts to turn away from these overland routes that are becoming less stable, and they start to turn towards the sea. And this is going to result not only in the exchange of goods, as we've seen in previous periods in terms of trade, but also the exchange of ideas. And that's really where Islam's going to come to play. So 131 is going to talk about marriage and family in pre-Islamic Arabia. And just some things that the book hits on is the idea that women are going to have greater freedom in general terms. They're going to play a pretty key role in different features of the economy. They're not going to be as restricted as, let's say, women in the Persian Sasanian Empire at this time. But men definitely still take primacy in terms of their rank in society. And what you need to remember in some nomadic societies, thinking back to period two, don't forget this, is that there tends to be a more egalitarian relationship between men and women. Just due to the nature of the type of work they have, what the men are doing, whether it's going and acquiring animals, roaming out on the steppes, it leads to women kind of taking more charge within the home and having more power. Great example of the role of women in pre-Islamic Arabia, or even early Islamic Arabia, is going to be Khadija. And Khadija is the wife of Muhammad. She's got an interesting life. She's a super successful businesswoman. She plays a huge role in trade in the Arabian Peninsula. She's the one who proposes to Muhammad, not the other way around. As Muhammad starts to have his prophetic revelations from the angel Gabriel, she really helps him to make some serious key decisions about what to do with these revelations. So a little bit of insight into the status of women in Arabia, thinking about 3.3 there. But let's move into the early life of Muhammad, going back to key concept 3.1. As your book talks about, Muhammad is born into the prominent clan that's a part of the larger Quraysh tribe, loses his father and mother at an early age, but he's going to be raised by his uncle Abu Talib, and this uncle, who is a merchant, is going to kind of lead him on a path that's going to expose him to Christianity and Judaism and a lot of other ideas that are kind of circulating around Afro-Eurasia at this time. So through that, you know, we're going to see some of the influence of Christianity and Judaism on the foundations of Islam. Take, for example, when Muhammad receives his message from God, it's from the angel Gabriel, the same one who tells Mary that she's going to bear the Son of God. And also, too, the fact that Muhammad gets a title called Prophetic Messenger, that also comes from Christianity as well. And, you know, Christians, Jews, Muslims worship the same God. They all trace their lineage back to Abraham. However, Christians and Jews will trace it through Abraham's son Isaac, whereas the Muslims will trace their son, their lineage, to his other son Ishmael. And they even believe that it was Abraham who initially built the first Kaaba in Mecca. So you see these different types of influences from Christianity and Judaism popping up in Islam right from the get-go. So I want to expand a bit on the Arabs and Islam section, as well as the universal elements in Islam, which starts on 134 and goes a tiny bit into page 136. Definitely look over this portion. there's things to talk about, you know, why is this religion attractive to Arabs? What are the beliefs that even attract people outside of the Arab world? What are the essential beliefs of Islam? And I'm not going to rehash all of those things, but I'll give you a little bit of more explanation about what's going on here. So we talked earlier about the geography of the Arab world, you know, just to the south of the Sassanid and Byzantine empires, is going to allow early Muslims to have this access to these people living on the fringes of those two empires, or maybe looking for what I've heard another podcaster, who I'll mention later to you guys, are potentially looking for this thing called a third option, an alternative to either the Byzantines or the Sasanians. Because what's been happening, and again, I glanced on this a little bit earlier, the Byzantines and the Sassanids have been fighting each other for such a significant amount of time, and the people are becoming emotionally exhausted, physically exhausted, financially exhausted, and these people who are living on the fringes are being oppressed in lots of different ways. If they're not practicing Christianity, the faith of the Byzantines, or Zoroastrianism, the faith of the Sassanids, they're going to be persecuted for that. They're going to be overtaxed as these imperial treasuries demand more and more. And so these people on the fringes are going to turn to this quote-unquote third option, the Muslims, because they feel like it's a better alternative to the other two, and some are going to even decide to convert to the religion, although that's not really the emphasis on the early spread of the Islamic empires. Those who didn't convert could continue to practice their religion. They couldn't convert others to their religion, and they had to pay something called the jizya, which is a tax for non-believers. Muslim armies, though, are going to have a lot of success in these two empires pretty early on. They're going to move into Syria and Palestine and take it from the Byzantines, conquer Mesopotamia from the Sassanids. Later on, get into Egypt, take all of Persia, destroy the Sassanids, so that by the early 8th century, not only are they expanding in Asia and into Africa a little bit, by the early 8th century, they're moving into the Iberian Peninsula, conquering modern-day Spain. And it's only going to be in 732 CE where they finally are pushed back at this famous battle called the Battle of Tours, which takes place in modern day France. So they're spreading really far, really wide, and it's not only quote unquote by the sword. There's also just an appeal. This group of people has a viable third option, third way that to some seems more appealing than what the Sasanians or the Byzantines have been offering. And although some people will convert to Islam in the early years, again, that's not a driving emphasis of the religion. This empire works in a way that the more empire they get, the more booty or the more wealth that they get from acquiring new territory. And that is going to be divided amongst followers of the religion. So the more people you convert, the more you have to divide up what you've gained from this new territory. So there's not a lot of incentive for the leaders of the empire to want to get more converts, because then that means at the end of the day, less money for them. So obviously, so far, I haven't really given much information about Muhammad. I think your book does a good enough job of that. But where I want to pick up with is going to be in the problem of succession. When Muhammad gets older, as he starts to see the writing on the wall that he's not going to live forever, he doesn't do anything to establish a procedure for appointing a successor or a caliph of the empire. So it's going to be between basically Ali, who is the cousin and the son-in-law of Muhammad, and then the other is going to be Abu Bakr, who is his closest friend, his earliest follower. And it's eventually here where we see the rift of Sunni and Shia, Shia meaning sons of Ali, start to emerge. And I want to emphasize to you guys that this relationship isn't always a violent one. It's not always this direct sense of hostility. Ali does get assassinated when he becomes the fourth caliph by his enemies. Those enemies are going to be later known as the Umayyads. That's going to be your really first official formalized Islamic caliphate. And they're going to come to power. They're going to move the capital of the caliphate to Damascus to more centrally locate it within the empire, but then the Shia are going to continue to resist the Sunni Umayyads, and even this other group called the Sufis are going to reject the luxurious ways of the Umayyads and start to decide they want to pursue a life of simplicity and devotion. So yeah, definitely the roots of the Sunni-Shia conflict have their origins in violence. There are times of peaceful coexistence between the two. If you look at the more recent history, especially in places like Iraq, Syria, and even in between Yemen and Saudi Arabia and Iran playing a role there, there's definitely increased tensions between Sunni and Shia, but that hasn't always been a thing. And we'll get at how that changes and where it stays the same as we get through the course this year. I just wanted to touch on what your book discusses, starting on 139, going to 140 a little bit, which is going to be the family and gender roles in the Umayyad age. It talks about a few things, some of which I'll repeat here. The idea that marriage is important for both the husband and the wife. The idea that we're going to get rid of female infanticide, which basically means if you have a female child, you cannot just kill her because she's not desired by the family. Women get more property rights. There's not much discussion about veiling or seclusion of women in the Umayyads. And as I'm saying all this, for those of you who don't have a real intimate familiarity with Islam, it might strike you as weird because you typically would associate Islam with being what you imagine to be very repressive with women. And it's at this point, I kind of want to emphasize something to you. And it's this idea that Islam, although it is often associated with repression and the seclusion of women, we have to keep in mind that religion, as in many different religions, are going to often be used as a means to secure political control, whether that's for an individual or a group or a class of people. And we're going to learn later on the ulama, who are going to be your religious scholars. They are going to ensure that in the times after Muhammad, they use the hadiths, the sayings and the traditions of Muhammad, as a way to justify their political actions. And so what they're going to do is they're going to take that original intent and actions of early Islam, and they're going to maybe twist it to suit the narrative that they want, which only serves to increase their power. So we've been discussing historical context, and the actions of early Islam really need to be understood in context and when they stray from the words and deeds of Muhammad. So we can ask ourselves, is this development in Islam a product of the religion itself, or is this a time where the religion is being distorted because in that historical moment, in that historical context, it suits a political goal? And that is an important thing with religion and history and politics all throughout. Depending on the political moment, religion can be used as a means to devise further and further control. And we have to keep that in mind. So the book from there gets a little bit into the decline and the collapse of the Umayyads, basically saying, I'll sum it up super briefly here, they got super soft, they enjoyed a high standard of living, they really forgot the everyday man. And so a group of people known as the Abbasids are going to start to rebel against them, going to have a major success in battle against the Umayyads. They don't wipe out the Umayyads there, but they kind of say, hey, let's let bygones be bygones. Let's get together for a dinner with these Umayyads, hang out, try to understand each other. So the Umayyads agree to this dinner, and instead of the Abbasids being the good guys and patting them on the back and saying, let's solve it, they decide instead to slaughter the remaining Umayyad leadership at this dinner. For those of you who have watched the Game of Thrones, you might be familiar with the scene, something familiar to this process happening here. But one of the leaders of the Umayyads does escape and goes to Cordoba, which is in Spain, and he's going to establish there the Caliphate of Cordoba, which is going to be kind of the Umayyad holdout away from the rest of the Abbasids located in Africa and Asia. So talking about key concept 3.2, to just kind of jump around a little bit here, as you get later on into the chapter and we're talking about town and country, the commercial boom and agrarian expansion, it does discuss some inventions or some new technologies, complicated or not, that are being used at this time just to further facilitate trade. You have the dhow ship, which is going to really help sailors in the Indian Ocean network throughout the Red Sea. Camels, super technologically cutting edge. But in all seriousness, camels being super important because it's an animal that can sustain itself for far greater amounts of time on far less resources than, let's say, a horse. So making treks through a desert can happen a lot more easily with camels. But these different technologies, I'm complicated again, so I'm not helping to stimulate trade throughout Africa, Eurasia, and really just helping link the Muslim network across large swaths of the globe so that you're going to have Arab scholars who are going to dedicate themselves to preserving the texts of the ancient Greek world throughout the Mediterranean into the Middle East, helping us preserve knowledge of that classical world. They're going to get ideas from India, like the number system, the concept of zero, and they're going to help facilitate those ideas and those beliefs, as well as those goods, of course, throughout Africa and Eurasia. So it's with the last point that I made with you folks about the Arab world or Arab scholars taking these ancient Greek works and translating them and making use of them for their own purposes that I'd like to focus on for the zooming in part. There's an article in a magazine that we'll talk about later on this year called Eon. And the article focuses on the translating of Greek works into Arabic by the Abbasids. And it kind of talks about this idea that, you know, we credit the Arab world with preserving the knowledge of the Greeks. And they did that, and they deserve that credit. But the question is like, why did they do that? What was the purpose of doing that? And the article is pretty brief, but it lays out two reasons as addressing the why. And the first why they give is, the first reason they do is because political ambitions. These Abbasids want to set out their own cultural traditions that separate them from the Persians, that can maybe even demonstrate that they're better than the Byzantines. And how better to do that than to take the Greek works that the Byzantines pride themselves in so much and do a better job of sustaining and kind of understanding those Greek texts and that knowledge. And then the other reason they give as to the why they preserve this work is because of religion, believe it or not. And why they did it in terms of religion is because they believed that comprehending Greek philosophical texts could ultimately help them better understand and defend their own religious beliefs. And if you think back to Augustine of Hippo, he kind of did that with the work of the ancient Greeks and Christianity. So that's not a brand new idea to us. But the article also talks about this thing, and that's translation, which sometimes even I overlook. And it's really important to think about for a second. If you think about, you know, the words of the ancient Greek world being translated into Arabic, you're talking about two different languages that really don't share too many common features. So there's plenty of words between the two languages that wouldn't translate directly from Greek and into Arabic. So what's really important to keep in mind then is that the translator, whoever's taking this original work, needs to make decisions about substitute words that can potentially alter the original meaning of the text. And then the reader of this translation could potentially be unaware of what's lost inside of the translation. And so I guess the point I'm trying to make with that is just the really powerful idea that one word can transform our understanding. And as we go and translate text from one language and into the next, we can potentially lose a significant bit of the meaning. So to have these people who can speak multiple languages, who can understand one from the other and understand the nuance in that is super important, because people like you and me, and probably speaking more personally here than I am about you, I think, but people like me who can only speak one language is really at a loss because I can't understand the nuance of some of those translations and I can lose some of that original meaning if I'm reading the text secondhand through a translation. So just something to keep in mind as you look at sources that are translated, I think. All right. With today's explainer, I want to try a little bit something different here, and that is practicing a skill we're talking a lot about in class, which is sourcing a historical document. So this one comes from Khalid ibn al-Walid, who was one of Abu Bakr's chief generals, Abu Bakr being basically Muhammad's right-hand man. I'm just going to read you the source, and then I'll kind of explain how we're going to source this one. So it says, quote, In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, this is what Khalid ibn Ali al-Walid would grant to the inhabitants of Damascus. He promises to give them their security for their lives, property, and churches. Their city wall shall not be demolished, neither shall any Muslim be quartered in their houses. Thereunto we give to them the pact of Allah and the protection of his prophet, the caliphs and the believers. So long as they pay the tax, nothing but good shall befall them. So I want to focus with this source, historical context. And the historical context in this image will be available on the blog as well, so you can check it out. It says it right above it here. This is the terms of surrender for the people of Damascus. And it says, before entering the newly conquered city of Damascus in the northern Arabian province of Syria, Khalid ibn al-Walid, one of Abu Bakr's chief generals, detailed the terms of surrender. So this is coming after they've acquired Damascus, which was a part of the Byzantine Empire. And this context is important for us to understand because it explains why he is emphasizing the fact that these people, although they are under new leadership, will be secured the right to their property, the right to their religion, and the right to peace and security, so long as they pay the tax. So context everything is everything there, because it explains why he's really trying to calm the fears of people. They've just been conquered. They're under these new rulers. And Abu Bakr and Khalid ibn al-Walid and Muhammad, they don't want to make problems for themselves by making these people feel insecure. Because if these people feel insecure, then what's going to end up happening is they're going to rebel, or they're going to maybe not want to be ruled by the Muslims. And then that creates problems for the Muslims. So this is why they're going to such great lengths to say, everything's going to be okay. We will not damage your property. We will protect you. We will not be putting troops in your home. So if you pay the tax, things will be good to go. And if you remember what we were saying earlier, people in the far reaches of the Byzantine and the Sasanian empires weren't necessarily resistant to the idea of a third option. And when this quote-unquote third option comes in and they're saying, look, it's all good. I know we're new, but give us some time. Let us do our thing. You'll be fine. Maybe you might like us. So there's a little bit of an introduction, a historical context to how you can use that to source documents and how that historical context can help kind of shape what you understand about the document. So in the recommendations for today, this is a podcast that I've personally been listening to over the last 4 months or so, probably since about July. And the podcast is called Head on History. And I love this podcast because, you know, it would be super useful for you folks to listen to, because starting right from the beginning, he goes into far more detail and much more gripping accounts of the early history of Islam. But the coolest thing about this podcast that I'm starting to find is that he's bringing in discussions of more modern issues surrounding Islam. You know, as I scroll through this list, yes, there are episodes on Al-Andalus, which is Cordoba, basically, that we had talked about earlier. There's episodes on Islam and Afghanistan, the history of the Shia, what's gone on with Islam in Iran. But then there's been episodes talking about Islam in America, Islam in China, Islam in Southeast Asia, Islam in Europe. And he talks about how this religion has interacted with these different regions throughout time. And it has been so insightful. And it's just highly recommended. Really good stuff. Looking forward to every episode that he puts out. And again, that's Head on History. And I'll link that in the description of the podcast for you as well. But I think that about does it. We're hitting near that half an hour mark. I think I squeezed in a good bit here into this episode. You know what to do. If you've got questions or comments or concerns, feel free to drop me a line. Poke your head in the door in school. If you see me in school, if you go to my school, you're probably the only ones listening to this podcast anyway. But yeah, I think that's all I've got for you for now. So until next time, I'll talk to you soon. Take care, everyone.